okay. We're going to start, only because we've got, I think, a lot of material we want to cover. Bill Fletcher on the far left, Sean Ahern, and I'm Doug Perry. We're going to just do three presentations. Mine's going to, unfortunately, I'm going to read it. I didn't know I'd have a slide presentation available. It's going to take about 20 minutes to get mentally ready. Sean's going to talk about situation, education in New York City. And Bill says he has talking points on the overall topic. Is that correct, Bill?
That's correct.
So if it's okay, we'll get started. I want to apologize. Keep your interest. I'll try and keep it small. But I will make some important points. Now, I'm going to be talking about insights drawn from Hubert Harrison and Theodore W. Allen on why no socialism in the U.S. And I've been intimately connected working on these two people for about the past 35 years or so. I have both questions on paper. I'm pretty familiar with their work. So I want to share some insights from them. The anti-white supremacist, working-class intellectual activist Hubert Harrison and Theodore W. Allen are two of the most important thinkers on race and class of 20th century America. Harrison, the father of modern radicalism and a self-described radical internationalist, was a leading black activist, organizer, and theoretician of the Socialist Party circa 1912, founder of the New Negro Movement, a major radical influence on A. Philip Randolph and Marcus Garvey, and the only person to play unique leading roles in the largest class radical and largest race radical movements of his era. Allen was active with the Communist Party, the POC, and Harper's Ferry Organization, originated the White Skin Privilege Analysis in 1965, wrote Can White Radicals Be Radicalized in 1967, began formally publishing his analysis on the invention of the white race in 1974, and completed his two-volume Invention of the White Race in 94 and 97. In 1926, and you have a quote here, you can see it, when Harrison was teaching at the Communist Party's Workers' School, he was teaching a problem on world problems of race at the Communist Party Workers' School and the Institute for Social Study, which had over 70 regularly attending of the leading black intellectual activists in Harlem. He writes, the King James Version, and he presented this, of the Bible does not contain the word race in our modern sense. So as late as 1611, our modern idea of race had not yet arisen. Allen writes on the cover, the back cover of the first volume of his book, which he spent 25 years researching, primary research. When the first Africans arrived in Virginia in 1619, there were no white people there, nor according to the colonial records would there be for another 60 years. And he adds that his examination of 885 county years of pattern-setting Virginia records. The county year is York County, 1660. That's one county year. In 885, virtually every record that had existed, and he would go down and was transcribing them, he says he found no instance of the official use of the word white as a token of social status prior to 1691. He also argues not only did he not find any use of the word, but the functioning white race was not functioning. Harrison was born in St. Croix. Harrison lived 1883 to 1927. He was born in St. Croix, Danish West Indies, came to the U.S. as a 17-year-old orphan in 1900. In the U.S., he quickly encountered a vicious white supremacy marked by lynching, segregation, and disfranchisement that was quite unlike anything he knew previously. The key was that the color line was drawn differently in St. Croix and in the U.S. In St. Croix, where 80% of the population were black, 5% European, and 15% colored, mixed African, European ancestry, the European ruling elite had, for social control reasons, implemented a policy of promotion of a significant sector of the African descended population. During slavery, free coloreds served in the militia, which was the principal arm of social control instrument, and in 1834, they were extended an edict of full equality, a law. The ruling class, who wants to make the rule, extended that law. In contrast, under racial slavery in the United States, slave patrols were lily white. Black people had no rights that a white was bound to respect. That's the Dred Scott decision, right? And the general policy was one of severe racial proscriptions for African Americans. So the contrasting promotion versus proscription policies led to markedly different social practices. In post-emancipation St. Croix, there was no history of lynch terror, no formal segregation, and class development amongst African Americans was fostered. White supremacy was not as virulent or as organized as it was in the U.S. Harrison and other early 20th century Caribbean immigrants commented on this. His friend, Jamaica-born Claude McKay, explained when he came to the U.S., it marked the first time he had ever come face-to-face with such manifest implacable hatred of my race, and though he had heard of prejudice in America, he never dreamed of it being so intensely bitter. Allen describes the nature of the oppression in Virginia as racial, and in the Caribbean as national. He explains racial oppression differs from national oppression in the rules for recruitment to the intermediate buffer social control stratum. It begins with racial privileges extended to those of the oppressed group and depends on the denial of the legitimacy of social distinction within the oppressed group. With national oppression, social control depends upon the acceptance and fostering of social distinction within the oppressed group. Harrison was an ardent opponent of racial oppression in the U.S., and beginning with his very first article to the New York Times in 1903, he speaks of racial oppression. As a socialist, he wrote on the socio-historical development. He lays out many of the positions that influenced the left at its best in this country on these questions, and I'm going to be very brief here. He wrote on the socio-historic development of racism in the U.S. He made the struggle against white supremacy central to his efforts domestically and internationally. He argued that it was the principal duty of white socialists to oppose white supremacy. He proposed a new litmus test for socialists, the duty to champion the cause of the Negro as a revolutionary document. In this, he proceeded to voice great test of the American socialist concept by 1 year and the Communist Party's position taken in 1928, which they made it the principal duty to fight white chauvinism by 16 years. He also criticized racism as innate arguments. He emphasized that race prejudice and inferior economic status of the colored race are in the interest of the capitalists of America, not in the interest of the workers. He emphasized the proletarian nature of the black masses, including during slavery. He's calling enslaved African American proletarians. And again, he foreshadows both Du Bois and Allen. He also learned from the autonomous efforts of women's clubs and foreign language federations to urge special approaches and appeals to reach African Americans, and he urged black people to be proactive, not to wait for help from the so-called white race. As a socialist, Harrison offered profound insights on the twofold nature of, quote, democracy in America. The twofold concept comes from Marx talking about capital, but it's this, by twofold character of democracy, what I'm referring to is that when democracy is a whites-only or a white supremacist democracy, it's a retardant to social progress. When democracy is thoroughgoing and genuine and challenges white supremacy, it's a catalyst for progressive social change. So in 1911, as a socialist, Harrison writes, politically, the Negro is the touchstone of the modern democratic idea. A touchstone is a black stone rubbed against gold to test the purity of gold. It's an extraordinary choice of words, and I think we can apply it in all our work today. Housing, education, incarceration, pick an issue, and let's apply the touchstone, so let's see how black people are faring. And then let's see what we're going to do about it. In the same passage, Harrison adds that true democracy and equality implies a revolution startling to even think of. In this, I think he clearly foreshadowed the civil rights, black liberation struggles of the 1960s, which challenged the existing social order and served as a catalyst for the anti-war, women's, student, Latino, Asian, labor, and other movements of social progress and change. In yet another commentary on World War I that could apply today in regards to Iraq and elsewhere, Harrison explained that, quote, the idea of democracy was widely advertised, mainly as a convenient camouflage behind which competing imperialists masked their sordid aims. Those who so loudly proclaimed the new democratic demands never had the slightest intention of democracy. So again, it's twofold character of democracy. Very importantly, in a major theoretical article prior to the 1912 Socialist Party Convention, Harrison pointedly raised the question, Southernism or socialism? The Socialist Party responded at that convention by ignoring the Negro question But in its discussion on Asian immigration, it took some of the most rabidly racist positions in the history of the left, replete with calls for restricting the invasion of the white man's domain by other races, and with a majority resolution that maintained that class consciousness must be learned, but race consciousness is inborn and cannot be wholly unlearned. Harrison would constantly go after that racism as a name position. When Harrison left the Socialist Party, he offered, find it quick. He offered what is arguably, I'm going to throw it up on the board, the most profound. When Harrison left the Socialist Party, he offered what is arguably the most profound but least heeded criticism in U.S. left history. This is back in 1914-15. He stated simply that the Socialist Party and the labor movement has insisted on the white race first and class after. That have put the white race first before class. This is back then. This is the core of his criticism. The historian Winston James concludes that American socialism did not keep faith with Harrison. Harrison kept faith with socialism. In his latter years, in the absence of white radicals making it their principal duty to oppose white supremacy, Harrison went off on a more independent path, concentrating work in a black community. He strongly criticized white capitalist imperialism, called for a colored international, and from 1924 until his death, called for the setting up of the state or states in the Union as a homeland for those African Americans desirous of living there. The system of racial oppression experienced by Harrison when he came to the U.S. has received its most historically insightful treatment in the seminal work of Theodore W. Allen, who describes how, one, the white race was invented as a ruling class social control formation in response to labor unrest as manifested in the latter Civil War stages of Bacon's Rebellion, 1676, 1677. A system of racial privilege, too, a system of racial privilege was deliberately instituted in order to define and establish the white race. And three, the consequence was not only ruinous to the interests of African Americans, but was disastrous for the white worker. Allen makes clear that the invention of the white race was a political act and no part of genetic evolution. He's not talking biology. And I'll just say on my webpage, which is simply my name with a net after, jeffreyberry.net, you will find all kinds of writings from Harrison and Allen for free. In his writings on the colonial period, Allen argues convincingly that white supremacism is not an inherited attribute of the European-American personality, that racism is not a name, and racial oppression is not dependent on phenotype or skin color. He spends much of his first book talking about racial oppression in Ireland. He details the reduction in the United in colonial Virginia, the reduction of European free laborers and tenants to chattel bond servitude in Virginia in the 1620s. Notes that of the 92,000 Europeans who arrived in Virginia and Maryland between 1607 and 1682, over three quarters were chattel bond servants. And he points out that in the 1670s, up till the 1670s, before the development of racial slavery, three quarters of the chattel bond servants in Virginia were Europeans, European Americans. He also highlights the transcendent importance of the fact memorialized in an account by Captain Grantham in 1677, in the final stage of Bacon's Rebellion, that 400 English and Negroes in arms, note, there were no whites, fought together, demanding freedom from bondage in the latter stage of Bacon's Rebellion. Allen details how, after Bacon's Rebellion, the plantation elite, this is the driving force, right? The plantation elite contrived a new social status, a white identity, designed to set European Americans at a distance from African American bond laborers and to enlist European Americans of every class in their system. The key to this counterfeit of social mobility was to reissue long-established common law rights incident to every, quote, free man in the form of white privileges. Presumption of liberty, right to get married, right to carry a gun, right to read and write, right to testify in legal proceedings. The successful function of this status required that African Americans be excluded. Allen is clear in his work. The record indicates that laboring class European Americans in the continental plantation colonies showed little interest in white identity before the institution of the system of race privileges. The plantation elite was the conscious force pushing the creation of the white race, and Allen emphasized that after African Americans were deprived of their long-held right to vote in Virginia, African Americans had the right to vote in Virginia, right? Governor William Gooch explained in 1735 that the Virginia Assembly had decided upon the curtailment of the franchise in order to fix a perpetual brand upon free Negroes and mulattoes. To Allen, this was clearly not an unthinking decision, which is a reference to the work of Winthrop Jordan. Rather, it was a deliberate act by the plantation bourgeoisie. In Virginia, persons of discernible non-European ancestry after Bacon's Rebellion were denied a role in the social control buffer. By contrast, in the Caribbean, mulattoes were included in the social control group and were promoted into middle-class status. For Allen, the difference was rooted in the objective fact that in the West Indies, there were too few laboring class Europeans to embody an adequate petty bourgeoisie, while in the continental colonies, Virginia and Maryland, there were too many to be accommodated into that land. Allen's writings, like Harrison, played a major, though often unacknowledged, role in influencing others. In 1997, Stanford professor George Fredrickson asserted that the proposition that race is a social and cultural construction has become an academic cliche. We've all heard that. Allen was not happy with this. He said, viewing race as a social and cultural construction has value in treating it as a historical rather than a biological category, but it's insufficient for reputation of race. He stressed that the logic of race as a social construct must be tightened and the focus sharpened, and the white race must be understood not simply as a social construct rather than a genetic phenomenon, but as a ruling class social control formation. He added, it's not just race in general that must be understood, but the white race in particular. So the white race must be understood not simply as a social construct, but as a ruling class social control formation. This position is consistent with Allen's repeated efforts to challenge what he considered to be the two main arguments that undermine in the song the struggle against the white supremacy in the working class. First, the argument that racism is innate. Second, the argument that European American workers benefit from racism. These are the two arguments he went after. The arguments opposed by Allen are related to master historical narratives. Remember today, Bill talked about the need for counter narrative, right? And I think Allen offers that. The first argument about racism being innate is associated with the unthinking decision explanation for the development of racial slavery offered by historian Winthrop Jordan, who you'll find still cited by many progressive historians and leftists, but that's the core of his argument. The second argument is associated with historian Edmund Morgan, who maintained that as racial slavery developed, there were, quote, this is a quote from Morgan, there were too few poor European Americans on hand to manage the poor whites to matter. That's the situation in the Caribbean. That's not the situation in Maryland. Morgan goes even further in his analysis, and this is part of a much larger thing, and offers what Allen describes as an assessment of white supremacism in relation to the foundation of the United States as a republic in a positive light. We're talking about master narratives now. To Allen, the essence of Morgan's thesis, and you've heard this in many forms, I think, is that democracy and equality, as represented in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, were made possible by racial oppression. Or as Morgan states it, the slavery of Afro-Americans made possible, indeed was essential, for the emergence of the notion of equality as a fundamental constitutional. So I guess it wasn't such a bad thing after all, right? That slavery is almost good. Allen offers the counter-narrative. Allen counters that given the solidarity shown during Bacon's Rebellion, and Bacon's Rebellion was on the heels of 10 major labor class and bond servant revolts from 1660 to 1676, in which this solidarity was being shown. Allen counters that given the solidarity shown during Bacon's Rebellion, here's what Allen argues, the non-enslavement of European American laborers, extending the racial privileges, was the necessary precondition for the development of racial slavery. So he stands Morgan on his head. Now, rather than Allen was convinced that it was not enough to simply counter the theses of Jordan and Morgan and the arguments that racism innate and that workers benefit. What was needed, he concluded, was a self-standing, completely opposite theory. So the embryo, the basics of that, he offers in the following. Again, racial slavery and white supremacy in this country was a ruling class response to labor unrest. Two, that the system of racial privileges was deliberately instituted, this is coming from the ruling class, right, in order to find and establish the white race as a social control formation. And three, the consequence was not only ruinous to African Americans, but disastrous for the white worker. To Allen, there was nothing positive in the white race or in identifying as white. In his personal and political life, he tried not to think or act white. He considered it the special obligation of the European American worker to act by resigning from the white race and joining the human race as a proletarian free of the incubus, free of the devil of the white identity. It should be noted that Allen shied away from the term whiteness because, as he explained, it's an abstract noun. It's an abstraction. It's an attribute of some people. It's not the role they play. And the white race is an actual objective thing. He's not talking biology. He's talking social biology. It's not anthropologic. It's a historically developed identity of Europeans and Anglo-Americans, and it has to be dealt with. It functions in this history of ours, and it has to be recognized as such. Another important Allen contribution is his development of the white skin privilege concept in 1965. This is decades before many people who were associated with the concept as originators. He considered the white race privileges to be the structural principle essential to the social order based on enslaved labor that is still essential to America's social order based on wage labor. Racial privileges under both systems, even after emancipation. He explained that these privileges reestablished after the Civil War in areas including employment, immigration, access to land, do not permit the masses of European workers nor their children to escape into the ranks of the property classes. It is not that the ordinary white worker gets more, but that the black worker gets less. By thus inducing, reinforcing, and perpetuating racist attitudes on the part of white workers, the present-day power masters get the political support of the rank-and-file white workers in critical situations without having to share with them their super profits in the slightest. As one example, he cites statistics showing that in the South, where race privilege has always been most emphasized, the white workers have fared worse than the white workers in the rest of the country. In other historical writings, Allen details the role of theory and practice of white supremacy in shaping the outcome of three major crises between capital and anti-capital forces, Civil War, Reconstruction, Populist Revolt, and the Great Depression. He also analyzed what he referred to as the six-pronged rationale for the relatively low level of class consciousness in the United States. And this six-pronged rationale, when Allen first developed the analysis, was drawn from the writing of left and labor historians, including Engels, Sorg, Richard T. Eli, Hillquit, William Z. Foster. These are left and Marxist, you know, historians. The six prongs in that rationale for the relatively low level of class consciousness, and this was the historical consensus going back, was the heterogeneity of the working class, the free land safety valve, relatively higher wages, ease of social mobility, early development of pure and simple trade unionism, and Allen challenged this old consensus as being seriously flawed by erroneous assumptions, one-sidedness, and most of all by white supremacy. He said that each of these was more myth than reality, and each one was shaped historically by white supremacy. He countered with his own theory that white supremacy reinforced amongst European Americans was the main retardant of working class consciousness in the U.S., and that efforts at radical social change should direct principal efforts at challenging the system of white supremacy. In 1996, Allen explained that social control in the U.S. was guaranteed not primarily by the class privileges of the petty bourgeoisie, but by the white race privileges of laboring class whites, that the ruling class co-opts European American workers into the buffer social control against their own interests. And that the white race, by its all-class form, conceals the operation of the ruling class social control system by providing it with a majoritarian democratic society, right? In the name of democracy. Allen also maintained that since ruling class ideology was so dominant, the ruling class was able to dispense with the ideas of the Labour Party or the social democratic type. The reason for this, and this is what Allen concludes, was that among the masses of white workers, the bourgeoisie establishes the dominance of race consciousness as against class consciousness. That's Harrison Redux. That's the same conclusion Harrison takes. Based on this assessment, Allen argued that the strategic main blow for progressive social change must be aimed at the most vulnerable point, white supremacy. He argued that the white race has served as a historic guarantor of ruling class domination, and the main barrier to class consciousness in the U.S. is the incubus of white identity of the European American. Finally, I'm ready, just about to end and give you a quick sum. Allen's last major work towards a revolution in labor history, because we have many labor historians here in this group, draws on Karl Marx and his own primary research and proceeds from the premise that in the continental colonies, slavery was capitalism, the slave owners were capitalists, and the bond laborers were proletarians. In this work, he cites Harrison, who in 1912 writes in the International Socialist Review, "The 10 million Negroes of America form a group that is more essentially proletarian, and under slavery, they were the most thoroughly exploited of the American proletariat." It's also found in Du Bois, in Black Reconstruction, his most important historic work, in which he describes the black worker as the ultimate exploited and stressed that the labor movement, with few exceptions, never realized the situation. It never had the knowledge or intelligence to see in black slavery and Reconstruction the kernel and the meaning of the labor movement in this country. The importance of this point cannot be underestimated. As Allen explained, for many labor historians, worker implies being free, shadow bond labor, as if African Americans refer to as slaves as if they were not part of the American working class. By not treating black labor as proletarian, we provide a cover for class betrayal by whites for white labor. We also, as Allen explains, yield to what he calls the great white assumption. The unquestioning acceptance of the white identity of European Americans of all classes as a natural attribute rather than a social construct. This assumption, Allen adds, lies at the root of harmful distortions of the historical record, and we need to criticize and correct this if labor history is to contribute to the development of class consciousness of the American working class. In the last decade of his life, Allen offered instructions on some work that could be done. In particular, he encouraged taking on four challenges. First, to show that white supremacism is not an inherited attribute of European-American personality. Second, to demonstrate that white supremacism has not served the interests of laboring class Europeans. Third, account for the prevalence of white supremacism within the ranks of laboring class European-Americans. And fourth, by the light of history, consider ways whereby European American laboring people can cast off this incubus of white identity. Last paragraph. Hubert Harrison and Theodore W. Allen considered the struggle against white supremacy as central to the struggle for socialism. They both emphasized that white workers put the white race first before class, that this was the principal retardant to class consciousness in the U.S., and the principal reason why there's no socialism. As discussion of their work and efforts to social change move forward, they will be immeasurably enhanced by struggling against white supremacy and by doing so with an understanding that the white race is a political creation, a ruling class social control formation maintained by white racial privileges which are not in the interest of working people. These struggles will be further enhanced with the understanding that white supremacy, white race privileges, white race consciousness, and the white race social control formation are principal reasons why there is no socialism in the U.S.
I'll just talk. My name is Sean Ahern. I'm a New York City school teacher, and I met
Jeff and Ted probably around the same time, about 1971. And I was just a high school student, just got out of high school, and in high school we had the 1968 strike, some of you might be familiar with. And in my high school, we opened up the school, the local Black Panther Party, and some of the graduate teachers, we opened the school, we had a liberation school. So I was very familiar with this idea of the white socialist identity, because these were the people running the teachers' union. These were the people who struck and shut down the school system for 2.5 months in 1968. And so after the strike, I was only in 10th grade, so it was 11th and 12th grade, and it was like the arguments and the battles went on the whole time. It never stopped. So years later, you know, something that Ted said just resonated with me. I was young, what did I know, 17 years old, so, but it resonated with me. And I said, I have that experience with the school system as a young student, but there was something else, and it has to do with grandma. My grandma. One of six people, a family who came from Ireland, escaping after the Civil War. They were on the losing side, tens from Ireland. Four brothers, her and her sister. And they got off the boat around 1921. And so this is my family's story. And the sisters came after the brothers were already leaving. They were met on the dock because Ellis Island was closed by then. They were met on the docks in Manhattan, put in a cab, and driven up to Harlem. This is my grandmother's first day in America. I realized that she was a peasant. She was an oppressed race in Ireland. The English thought of them as like dirt. The black and tans would go around and terrorize people and shoot people. It was like, you know, they were the lower, they were an oppressed race. And she got off the boat, and here were her brothers who had all been in Ireland and would all been like IRA fighters, you know, fighting on the losing side of the Civil War, you know. Met her at the boat. They put her in a car and drove her to Harlem. These are black people. What's that? You're white. Huh? It was her first day in America. And her brothers had gotten here, and they had gotten jobs in construction trades, which at the time were like, it was a lockdown, you know, this is our thing, no blacks, you know, this is our thing, right? And so they were indoctrinating the sisters on their first day in America about what it meant to be white. Because she had no idea what the hell is that. It doesn't mean anything. But it meant something when she got off the boat. And so that was part of my family. You know, they hear this race talk, and my grandfather never bought it. Just made people shut up, tell them, people are people, shut up, you know. But the uncles were big into this, you know. And then I connected it with my grandmother. You know, you live a life of the working class. She was white. But what difference? Well, she lived the life of a working person. And she died sort of this kind of horrible death that many working people die. You know, when they're exposed to kind of toxic chemicals and wastes and all these kind of things, and you get these strange diseases. And you die these sort of horrible deaths. Both of my grandparents did. And I remember my grandmother on her deathbed. And I think that she's there with my great aunt, and you know, this, my great aunt's trying to cheer up. She's out of Mandarin, we had some fine times. And my grandmother looks up, and this is after her life, you know, 40 years of work in America, being white. She slips up and she says, Nora, we never lived. And so when you see somebody die after a lifetime, with anger, with frustration, with feeling like you were cheated. I connected that with her first day. And the life, unaware, unconscious. But that you realize at the end that you missed out on something. That something was wrong here. It was not what it was supposed to be. And so I think that that helped me. There's something that Ted said about, he said, you know, people who want privileges, you want race, you want white privileges, you don't want social. And, well, geez, I thought that was true. And I thought that the anger experienced by my grandmother, I think there's going to be a lot of people dying in America who are going to have a similar anger at the end, thinking that somehow, this wasn't supposed to happen to me. I wasn't supposed to lose my job. I wasn't supposed to lose my house. I wasn't supposed to die with nothing of some kind of illness that probably I got from my job. This wasn't supposed to happen. What happened to the American dream? What happened here? Something was wrong. And I think that what I liked about Ted was that he took history very seriously. And history for working class people is the story of our parents, of our grandparents. And if we as class conscious working people can take that further back and broaden out to an understanding of this country that we live in, that maybe we don't have to go to our end feeling unrealized in that same way that so many, that my grandmother did, and that I believe that so many people in America do. So many quote-unquote white people. They don't realize it until it's too late that something is wrong. And that wrong thing is the white race. And when Ted used to say, when I was a kid, he said, resign from the white race, kid. And he would just smile, thinking that like I was going to think he's crazy. He wasn't crazy, because he was onto something. And he spent 25 years, he took it very seriously, and he said, what is this white race thing? And he looked into it, and he wrote, he spent, never got a dime for it, never lived in poverty, but he did it. And I think it's a great contribution to it. I can't say that I've tried to do everything that he said to do, but here I am now, a New York City school teacher. New York City. I can't believe it. In the same neighborhood that I grew up in. I'm back. I was supposed to escape. Where's the American dream? What happened? I'm back where I started.
Same apartment.
But I like to think that maybe I'm a little more aware of what the hell is going on here. And I'm not punishing myself, and I'm not beating up myself or my wife or my kids. Because I'm a little more conscious of what is going on. I've been I'm a UFT delegate, a United Federation of Teachers. I hated the United Federation of Teachers. And here I am, a delegate. Okay? And I read a book about the UFT history because I lived it. It's a great book. The UFT banned it, basically. They won't even review it. I wrote a review of it. It was published in a few years ago in Socialism and Democracy. Thank you very much. But the UFT won't touch it. They won't even mention it. They issue out whole tomes of what I call white history to go with their white socialism. Okay? And it's called Tough Liberal by Kallenberg. It's a total whitewash of the 1968 strike, and a glorification and a white history, a whitewashed history of what happened. As a justification for the party that remains in power today, the Unity Party. But, I'm looking at just some of this. And one thing that Poder and this strike is, I'm going to try to wrap this up very quickly. One of the main things in 68 was very few black teachers in the university. 30% of the student body in 1967, 68 was black. Maybe it was about 6-7% teachers, maybe like one or two administrators. So one of the main issues in that strike was African-American teachers demanding some say in schools, demanding an increase in African-American teachers. So I was curious, I said, So I went to the UFT archives, trying to find out some information. What's the racial breakdown? This is in 2004, that summer. So I walked in, talked to the head, the amazing McAdoo, head of the research department. Amazing. What is the breakdown of the demographic, disaggregated by race? Do you have any statistics? What's going on now? She hands me a printout, and it's at the time Eva Moskowitz was the chairman of the education committee of the city council. Stanford, her office is the main one. She hands me this printout, and I think something about Ted, again, caused me to see something because, facts, right? There's facts all around us. What facts are important and what facts aren't important? Well, I think that Ted put something in my brain, like I got a little alarm clock that goes off when I see something that, whoa. And I look at this chart. I have copies here if anybody wants it. I look at this chart that says, wow, 2001, 27% of all new teachers hired were black. 2002, 19%. 16% Hispanic, 12%. That's 1 year for new hires. Well, it's more curious because for all the years before, we're going way back, there had been incremental increases in teachers of color coming into the system. So that was my little, like my training, my TED training was like, oh, whoa, the injustice button, just something's wrong there, right? So I go and I bring this to my colleagues, my fellow colleagues in the union, right to Randy Weingarten, go to the opposition caucuses and say, look at this, there's something wrong. Oh no, that can't be the truth, it was denied. Or it was, it's not an issue, that's not important, it doesn't matter what race the teacher is, it just matters like what they're doing in the classroom. Right? You get a bad black teacher, you get a bad white teacher, it doesn't make any difference. So I said, no, this is not, no, something's wrong here, something's not on. So I stick with it. I go around, I make copies, and I give it around everybody I can give it around to. Some people pick up on it. And we get a story in Yesterday News. The reporter goes, I have a copy of the article, 2006. The reporter goes to the DOE and says, give me some information. Because the DOE doesn't want to release anything. But to the press, they have to give up some stuff or they get bad press, right? Especially from the Yesterday News. Gets the press. So she brings up the statistics here. 2006. Every year. Down, 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 down. Whoa. Yes, I got those statistics here too. I go back to my colleagues in the opposition. I go back to the UFT leadership. Look. Oh, well, you know, blacks are just not applying anymore. They're not interested in it anymore. You know, it's like, you know, it's unfortunate. Sure, we sure would like to have more black members, but, you know, if they don't want the job, what do you want us to do? The opposition, similarly, like, well, you know, what can we do about, you know, let's just stick to getting a decent contract, let's stick to having a democratic union, let's stick to, you know, what unites us. What are you coming in here bringing up this kind of stuff for? What do you want to do? You cause problems? So then it comes up again, we get another article up to 2007-2008, same pattern. I was involved in trying to get people to run for election, put this into the platform. I get some people together, we go to the UFT, we present the radical resolution for the Delegate Assembly to try to get the UFT to become a whistleblower on this issue. I write an article for the UFT, they manage to print it, but they won't do anything. Now, as a strategic point right now, because the teachers union is getting its ass kicked, right, up and down the block, right? This is the biggest union local in the United States of America. The UFT. Local 2AF Federation of Teachers. Over 100,000 members. Unlike almost any other union in the United States, they have a stable dues base, they got lots of cash, they got big buildings. Staff, you have over 100 people making over $100,000 a year in New York City alone. They got two big buildings down on Broadway, right around the corner from the Wall Street. 40-story buildings. Right downtown, financial district. They got loads of cash. They won't touch it. They won't do anything. But they're getting beat up by Bloomberg and Klein. Why? Because they're responsible for the achievement gap. The greedy union. The lousy union contract that's protecting all these incompetent racist teachers. And how do they get away? How does Bloomberg become the advocate of the union? How did this happen? Well, part of it happened because of the UFT's own shameful and sorry past that they refused to cut, they refused to break it. Rather than being the whistleblower on this, rather than being for legal solidarity, it's like, well, you know, maybe the black teachers should say something, or maybe the NAACP will bring it up. Whatever happened to solidarity? This is the meaning of solidarity. What's the antidote to what ails us right now in America? Solidarity. And in the context of the United States, solidarity means stop acting white. Act like a union person. Act like a class-conscious worker. And stop saying, well, you know, it's not really my issue. Whatever happened to an injury to one is an injury to all. That's what solidarity is, and that's what we're not doing. So in conclusion, I believe that by taking up the struggle against this kind of affirmative action plan for whites that's going on in the Board of Education right now, by taking it on as our issue, then we affirm solidarity in practice, and that can have a very powerful effect. That can have a very powerful effect. We might not be able to challenge them with their money and their all these other things, but the Board of Education, the corporate defense against teachers is vulnerable on this point. But you cannot pick it up if you're going to think white and act white. You can't even pick it up. It's lying there. Solidarity. Pick it up and use it. But they can't do it because they're thinking white and they're acting white. And I think that, on a positive note, when I stop yelling and screaming and I try to speak calmly and I present data in a real way, right, and I make it attached, you know, I make it a documented case, nobody comes up and says, oh, go away. Everybody pretty much says, oh, yeah, well, you know, that's thank you for bringing it up, you know, and they go along the way. If more and more people can do this, I believe that it's so strong, convincing, and compelling that we can actually do something quite different than we have in the past and really chart a new course for the Federation of the Teachers. Thank you.
So, good afternoon. And this is going to be difficult following the two of them, and also because of this very big danger that people are going to fall asleep. No, it's true. Between 1 in the afternoon and 4, we all, you know, sugar drops and people start going to sleep, and I get very upset when people fall asleep in front of me. So, I want to make sure we have enough time for a discussion. So, I just want to outline a few things. And some of them are differences with Ted Allen. And differences with Jeff. Let me start by saying that I'm someone whose politics was very much shaped by the work of Ted Allen and his writings, and feel that he was much of a mentor to me. But I found myself at certain points wondering about something. I believe that the article was by Engels. I think it was called On America. It's not a very long article, and I'm not sure who he was writing to, but he was trying to talk about what was the problem in the United States. And I'm not mistaken, that's where he says the Western frontier. And that has been interpreted generally as meaning that the ability of so-called freedom helped to downplay class consciousness. And I think that that's true, but I actually think that there's another way we can look at what Engels was writing about, which is that the United States was a settler state, and that the settler state, not the since the whole notion of the availability of free land, the land wasn't free, there were people there, right? The land had to be grabbed by somebody, and then it became free. So in other words, you had to have a settler state that grabbed the land, took it, and made it available for a certain population. So my first point is that I believe that what Ted was raising needs to be amended. So we have to understand, as I said this morning, we live in a racial separate state. And that even the example that Jeff was using, and Ted's famous example, of Begin's Rebellion, it's very important that we understand the context. That in Begin's Rebellion, as with the American Revolution, part of what was central was that these settlers, African-American who had become free as after being bond servants, as well as Europeans, were looking for land, right? And so I go back to that notion that for people like Jefferson, there was no contradiction between the idea of a republic and an empire, because to them the issue was, we're grabbing this land, we are expanding, and this appealed to a certain set of the population. The settlers were looking for land, they wanted a state that would produce that for them. That helped to shape the consciousness of the U.S. working class, and specifically, most particularly, the white working class, because the white working class saw itself, as I was raising this morning, as the relevant population. How I also started thinking about this was in the early 1970s. I was a fellow traveler with the Black Panther Party. I remember seeing these articles about the Israeli Black Panthers, and I read this, I said, wow, this is fantastic. There's a Black Panther organization in Israel. And I was really excited until I found out what they stood for. Right? You had this group of basically Sephardic Jews that were feeling persecuted by the European majority in Israel. But their attitude on Palestine was rapidly right-wing. You had this incredible contradiction of people that were basically saying, we exist in a situation where there is effectively racial discrimination between the European Jews and the non-European Jews, but we consider the Palestinians not human, and we are in favor of the expansion of the settler state to benefit us. So I think that when we're looking at this issue of why no socialism, not only in the United States, but also in places like Israel, what happened in South Africa, it's important to add to the analysis that Ted expressed, that the issue of the construction of a system of racial privileges is, without question, fundamental to the consciousness that emerged. But that there was another piece to this that we can't leave out, which is that the construction of these privileges took place in the context of the growth of a settler state that expanded, that absorbed northern Mexico, that absorbed the lands of the native peoples, right, and kept moving west. And in that move, part of what was very important in consciousness was the notion that there was a role for the white population in the growth of that settler state. And that the white population should, in fact, close its ears and close its eyes to the atrocities that were being committed by that settler state. Because in the end, the line was that they would themselves benefit from it. I'm going to leave it at that point. There's much, much more I could say, but I want to leave it there because I think that we should unpack this a little bit more and engage in another discussion. So let me just draw it together. I'm not fundamentally disagreeing with what Ted Allen and Cuban Harrison were raising. I'm saying that I don't think that it went far enough in terms of understanding what it is that we're up against, and that this growth of the empire, and the growth of the settler state helps us to understand sort of imperial consciousness that permeates much of the working class in the United States. There's this quote that I stumbled across from Freud, of all people. And it was very, very interesting. It was this quote, and I don't remember it in its entirety, but he basically said that the Roman plebeian, no matter how oppressed, will ultimately consider to identify with Rome insofar as they see themselves as part of the force that's ruling the world. And I think that material consciousness, the growth of the settler state, and the contributions that Ted and Hewitt made, I think we can put these together in order to advance our understanding of racial and national oppression. Thank you.
Just to follow up on Bill's last point, my name is Fran Short from Wayne State University. W.B. Du Bois has a phenomenal essay, I think it's in 1915, about the African basis for World War I. And in that, he essentially ties together the link between white supremacy and imperialism and makes a kind of analysis, which I think is another jumping off point very much in line with what you were saying, Bill, but also trying to draw together some threads that that you want to address it. So it's something to go back to and look at, because it does very definitely underscore the idea of this imperial consciousness. And if you look at how deeply embedded military-industrial complex is, and the role even in the UAW to protect the factories where the war production goes on, you see another element of the deep-rootedness of this imperial consciousness and the difficulty of getting beyond certain kinds of elements.
I think I agree with the I'm a long time student of course too. But I've also done a lot of study of my own family on the Western frontier, or what was the Western frontier, Scots Irish and Western Pennsylvania. So before the revolution and the role that they played both in relation to the slaves and in relation to the Brits. They hated both. And they were the buffer, the slave catchers for the favored role down further south. They were Indian killers up where I live. So they played a cool role, both the slave catchers and Indian killers. And they had a conflicted consciousness from day one. I don't use the term false consciousness, but I don't like it. I like conflicted consciousness. And I think part of their conflicted consciousness is part of their identity is white, which is Ed's whole analysis. But I think part of what Bill was saying is part of their identity is also that they are American. And that's where the separate state comes in. When they were on the frontier, the interesting thing is that the land didn't belong to them. For most of them, there's a myth that people were given all this free land, settlers were given all this free land. Most of them never got any land. They got land warrants. They would get out of the busted out of the army in Philadelphia. They would sell their land warrants for $5 just to survive to some land speculator who would then own the land. Then they would get out there. When they finally got out there, they were tenants, or they were squatters. Or they established what they call tomahawk plains, which is if you mark the trees and if you could defend it, after a while you could get the hold of it. Usually the land was held by huge eastern landowners that they had to buy it from for a long time. So it wasn't just that they got all this free land to be in settlers, they had to fight for it. They generally divided into three. They divided into Indian killers, who were the worst kind of terrorists. Took more scalps than any Indian. There were guys in the middle who just sort of wanted to survive. And then there were sort of religious types like the Mennonites who wanted to make peace with the Indians. But all of this, the first census was taken in 1790. I did this from tracing back in family history. And every one of those sheets, when you count, when the census takes three, white, male, and after that, Negroes and others, when they were knocking, cutting off the family. The original white skin privilege is embedded right into the deeds. It's been affirmative action for white folks from day one. So that's Ted's point. But I think Joe's point is there's also this question of thinking of themselves as Americans, as opposed to the French or the Spanish or whoever they were trying to take the land, or the Indians who they were trying to take the land from. So there's a kind of duality there in their consciousness. So you not only have to stop thinking of yourself as white, eventually you have to get to the question of your nationality as well, if you really want to get your class consciousness. So there's a couple of social constructs there. And this national privilege as well as racial privilege that we have to deal with.
Yes. Actually, I have a question. Kind of back and following up what you just said about whiteness and being an American. I teach associative inequality class at the community college. 18 to 35 year olds who are all pretty much white, and I have one, five students, one, or two Latino students, two Hmong students in my classes. And this notion of being American has become very, very controversial on our campus. And to the point where some of us are being told not to teach about whiteness, which is what I teach about, and things like that. And there's just this huge controversy about what does it mean to be an American? Is that not, because of course we all know it isn't. How, what would you say to respond to students? I know what I say, but I would love to hear what you all would say to that student who says, I'm an American. That is who I am. That is, you know, of course, I just want to hear what you would say to that student.
I actually don't use the term. No, I don't. I sometimes gets difficult in writing because I'm talking about how you call what we call people in the United States. But I feel like it's an affront to the hemisphere. So I talk about the people of the United States. But I think when you were raising the point, I started thinking about this law that got passed in Arizona. And this is an incredible battleground for us right now. Because what's going on in Arizona is really not about immigrants. It's about Chicanos and Native Americans. And it really goes to racial and national privilege, as Carlos pointed. So I feel like, you know, when people say that they're American, I like to just unpack that. What does that mean to you? You know, what's a Mexican? You know, what about people in Argentina? I ask people about that.
I don't know what you tell your sons.
I tell them, like, what you said. I refer to us as people in the United States. Because I'm Mexican.
Okay, my question is a little bit of a repeat of what I was trying to say in the morning, and probably nobody heard it, and maybe again it will not be heard. It's that I feel there is too much of American exceptionalism that's being discussed here in terms of whiteness and non-whiteness. I think the problem is a bit more general than just the question of America being a secularist. There is something historically specific about it. But the whole question of race, racism also developed in the context of colonization. What the British did to the Irish, what the British did to Indians in India. What is common between Indians in India and Indians in America? Even the term Indian, we all became Indians not by choice, but because someone who did not know history, a starving nation, you know, in 18th century, in 15th century India, no Indian was interested in knowing where Europe is. Europe was dying to discover India. In that process, that's what they found people who were looking different from them. They danced with joy, called them Indians, created a very serious historic problem that when Indians leave India, they have to define what kind of Indians they are, which is a racist problem. And I think when we are discussing this, we should bring that world history into it rather than looking at American history in isolation from the world history of racism. That's one. The second point is that I'm trying to understand from you, we have in India another problem. We are racist, probably more racist in India against Indians than you can ever understand. I'm talking about the caste system in India. And some of the questions that you are talking about, this is just my suggestion, that why being upper caste, being socialist, and being upper caste, and trying to do something about the lower caste, we have exactly the same problem that you were talking about. White privilege, white socialists are socialists. And I think doing some kind of comparative study of consciousness of socialism, caste, race, So the line he raised, I would suggest that bring past there, that how these social constructs come in the way of class consciousness interfering with it, or creating it, and I think that is
interesting. I'd like to, if I may, I'd like to get back to some of the issues Bill raised both now and in his earlier discussion. From what I understand, from what you said, from what I've read of some of the settler theory stuff, we say these settler states are racial states. And I have some historical problems with that when applied to the U.S. That's what I was posed right there. Because there was no white race in that early period. In my talk, I mentioned about the high number of chattel bond servants, Europeans. There was significant class difference. Right? I think that equating a lot of the settler state theory that I have seen, and again, you may have some different understandings, or you may have gone through this and said, well, that's not true, but this is, in terms of it. But a lot of it falls back into what Alan refers to as the great white assumption, as if this settler state speaks as one, this white race thinks and functions as one. And what I'm getting at is that this thing is ruling class driven, and it's not in the interest of the European American workers. What I think the settler state, from what I know, and I really want to hear your response because we've never had a chance to discuss this, but I think the settler state thing gets close to the notion of the white workers being bought off, and I'd like to know where it differs from that, this whole notion around the 60s and 70s. Because what Alan is offering, I believe, is a real, it's a counter, you spoke about the need for a counter narrative, and I think that's what Alan does. I think he's trying to offer one rooted in working class analysis. And of course, he and Harrison are tremendous internationalists. Harrison refers to himself, as I said in my opening sentence, as a radical internationalist, and he goes after this all over. But in the U.S., we're really dealing with these red states and these blue states, and these, we know what the core of that reaction is. It's that white race thing. That's the one we've got to deal with. And I often feel a lot of this other stuff wants to, go off in other areas. This is the one that we've got to deal with. And I think at least those of us active in the labor movement on the left got to come to some assessment of this white race. Is the great white assumption accurate? Should we all assume that's there? Or do we want to be looking at it and scrutinizing it and going after it? Is it in our interest? I don't think in the least. And I actually think, when I talk with lots of, I go around, the whole question of getting this younger generation involved. I think they may have a certain openness to not take for granted what we were brought up on, in certain ways. But I think we want to get out there because I don't think there's a damn thing progressive in identifying as white. And I think that message has to be driven home. I think we've got to get that all over. Because that's going to be, if we can do that, and I don't know that you win the majority of the European Americans, but if we can break off a significant chunk, that's the direction we want to move. I think we probably agree. But so, in terms of that settler thing, see, I'm familiar with Alan's work, and I did a lot of work myself in the 17th century, and it's rooted in historical fact and analysis. He transcribed 25 years all these county records, where laboring class European and African Americans have a voice in the court. He transcribes all this stuff. It's not just the imposition of a formula, on that early period, set the state theory like Israel. No, there's historical particulars in every country. And it's different in South Africa than the U.S. So I don't accept it. And again, for the reasons, I think it makes a great white assumption. I think it's not historically based. I think it doesn't address the question of class within that white race. It also, even on the question of the American, there's many other things that we'd have to pull out because what are African Americans? Where are they in terms of this American nationality? So I'd like to hear more on that. But those are some of the areas. Yeah.
Well, I think it gets very complicated. And so we have like 15 minutes for a discussion that could take us quite a long time. But I would say this, that the construction, where we would agree, the construction of race as we know it today begins to take place in Ireland in the 1500s, is transposed to the Western Hemisphere, and comes into fruition by the late 1600s. And even though it is true that Africans were first brought over as bond servants, although they were brought over, they didn't go down to the Atlantic and book passage, there's still this nagging question of Native American. So in that sense, the creation of the settler state wasn't the creation of a group of people that just got together the way the myth has it and said, you know, I hear that this is vacant land over here. Why don't we get on the ship and go over there? I mean, this was a project. It was a project driven by ruling classes in different countries. But when the settlers got here, in a variation on what Sean said about his grandmother, they had to make certain decisions. And there were certain decisions that were to the advantage of the white settler over the native population. The 1862 Land Act, I forgot the full name, is an example where land was opened up for the settlers. And it was opened up on a racial basis, right? It wasn't like African American could say, oh, I want some land. And it wasn't like Native Americans could say, oh, no, we get first dibs on this. Right? So there were things that were done, and as was said, a certain kind of affirmative action program to the benefit of whites. Now, does that mean so to the advantage of whites? I think we have to look at this straight on. This is a problem. When I look at what happened in the railroads, in the period from 1865 through the early 1900s, African Americans were driven out of the railroads in the South. Were driven out. There was ethnic cleansing of the railroads. I mean, there was this whole thing, those of you that are old enough to remember the Casey Jones television show with Fess Parker. It was like, there was this guy, there was a white guy, right? Well, at some point, a number of years ago, there was this whole debate as to whether Casey Jones was actually black. And I thought that this is a strange argument until you realize that so much of the railroads in the country were run by black folks. I don't mean owners. I'm talking about running. And so what happened? They were driven out. They were literally assassinated, or if they died off naturally, they were replaced by whites. I mean, so some people got jobs that they would not have otherwise gotten. We've got to deal with that. I don't know, you know, I used to get into these arguments, Jeff, about benefit versus this, and I don't know what you'd call it, but what's happened and why right-wing populism is so powerful is that white folks are starting to look around and they're saying, the state is not benefiting us anymore. We made these sacrifices. We remained silent when atrocities were taking place. And now, what the fuck is happening? Right? You know, why do we have Oprah there? Why is it Tiger Woods? Right? And see, and Jeff, I feel like we've got to deal with that somehow. And of course, the United States is different from South Africa. But there are these like remarkable parallels when you look at every settler state on this planet. And that is what I think we have to pay some attention to.
I have a question about the notion of the settler state in this early American history, and there's no language for white. Because in 1790, when Congress passes the Naturalization Act, you know, restricts immigration or naturalization to free white persons. Right? And that restriction remains in various forms active until 1952 or 3, you know, the mid-50s, right? And it's further, you know, kind of updated in the Civil Rights Act. So is the settler state an ongoing settlement, or is it an origins issue, right? Is it, you know, when you're thinking about that, are you thinking about colonies and westward expansion, or the continual process of who gets to be a settler based on skin color? Right. And based on, then the Supreme Court has all these cases about who's really white, and if you're Caucasian, are you white? If you're Indian, are you, you know, are Turks white? Are, you know, is this one right? And then the Supreme Court comes to the comment that's rational. Anyone who we think looks white is white. No one else is. That's a great book. Ian Haney Lopez's book, White by the Law, is fantastic. About that. So it's a similar statement I'm going to say. And then whether white workers benefit, in a narrow sense, you have to say they, because they got immediate. There was some immediate grabs based on only on race, but only to a point, because then we didn't get any meaningful redistribution of wealth. They didn't get any meaningful political power. They didn't get any meaningful quality of life. They got building trades jobs and railroad jobs and steel jobs and tract housing and a middle state that
takes. I like Bill's, when you're talking about the drowning person with the bag of gold.
Yes.
I think it's like that. You say, well, they got a bag of gold.
It's not.
But you're in the ocean, you know, and you better drop that bag of gold and get in the boat. Or else you're going to die. That's a bad person. You know?
I agree. And I think the settler state is both a question of the origin, but it's an ongoing project. And I emphasize the intersection. This is why I'm not like abandoned tech, right? I think that this racial settler state is an ongoing project. I mean, I wrote this piece for Black Commentator the other day about the Arizona law, asking the question, what does an illegal alien look like? And wondering what will happen when a Puerto Rican cop in Boston stops someone for being illegally Irish. I used to work with illegal Irish, right? And it's like, I don't know any of them that ever got stopped, jacked up by the law, right? Unless they were somehow connected with certain organizations, right? I will go nameless. So I think it's an ongoing project. That's the thing that I would emphasize. That the settler state is an ongoing project, and it intersects with it, and cannot be separated from the racial construction.
All the states in my first answer.
Hold on a second. Yeah.
Yeah. First, I want to thank all of you. I had a discussion with some of you earlier today as well. I am a teacher from Chicago, and I am in a charter school. And as I listened to you talk about just the government and the history of government in the United States of America, I realized that they are taking that exact same model, and they're pretty much funneling it to the school system. Schools that are underperforming are being shut. Charter schools are coming in. There are communities where abandoned buildings have been abandoned for years and they're buying up property where, I mean, as little as a dollar from the city of Chicago. And then they're getting funding to rebuild the buildings, and parents are assuming that because it's new paint on the wall, they have a few computers, and there's pretty clean windows, and they're not bulletproof windows like some of the other neighborhood schools, that therefore this must be a better place to send my child, but they have no clue that not one dime has been spent on curriculum. And just as they settled across America, they are settling in communities, especially urban communities, that are basically being raped of education. And they're just pretty much picking who's going to rape their kids with from their education, whether it's going to be in the regular school setting or if it's going to be in the new improvised charter school alternative setting. And this is happening all across America. It's happening everywhere. And it's happening in Chicago at a rapid rate because we have a mayor who's in total control. We have a CEO of the public school system that ran the transit system. And we have a secretary of education who's never taught a day in his life running the American school system. And so people are being grabbed out of Ivy League schools to do a service to urban education,
to give 3 or 4 years or 5 years and we'll pay back your student loans. And you've done a good deed. Hand clap. Now you go on to your corporate, private sector job because you've done your good deed. So there's a constant turnover, and that constant turnover is great for privatization because there's no solidarity. The unions are weak because it's a constant turnover, and the product is a group of students who are totally confused, who've seen chaos for the last 8 to 12 years, and they're not going to speak up and have a voice. And privatization will continue.
I'd like to say one more thing. If when black workers are excluded from union, or kicked out of union, that's a horror that we all would have caused. I don't think it's in a white worker's interest to go into a lily white union. This country is the richest in the world, but we can run it off. On healthcare, we're 39. I mean, pick the numbers, right? On length of the work week, we're 42nd. On maternity leave, pick an issue, right? And we're very on every issue. I'll sit and have lunch with Bill. I'll talk to Paul. I mean, all vets, that's all. People have been around. Where's the left nowadays, right? We are so far. I mean, we're talking about class interest. This is about socialism. That's this topic is. We ain't going to get there. Unless we deal with this white race thing. I mean, I think we all actually agree on this. But we got to focus on it. And I think Alan offers the best analysis of what it is. It is a ruling class social control formation. It wasn't here all along. I think Harrison is right when he says the problem is the white socialist and the white labor movement, but the white race first. It's maintained by racial privileges. Those privileges, whether it's a job or all white, are not in their interest. This is what Alan says. I think it's a good analysis. If I can, I would encourage people to read Alan and Harrison in the original. You can link them on the web. But these are our forebears, right? So we want to go through and see what they have to offer and see how it applies. Yeah, sorry. Hi, Mike.
So, let me just say something about this business about the white race is not in the interest of white people. I have never understood that claim. And you just said it again.
Yeah, I believe it.
Well, see, I think that the question is, what is the time horizon over which you're looking at? You cannot
reach it now.
Yeah, but if you're talking about just now, if you are talking about just at any given moment, I think it's absolutely silly to say that white people don't gain from the fact that black people can't have jobs that otherwise white people get. How is that possible that that does not benefit, just a second, white people at that moment? What you can say is that at that moment, if that's all you're looking at, that short-run view, you are missing how it is that in the long term, over your life, you're going to end up like Sean's grandmother. And I don't think that we can solve this problem simply by saying to white people, this is not in your interest. Because that is so contrary to what the actual benefit is to white people at any given moment. And the task is to get people to think beyond the immediate moment. And that's not just a question for Wall Street, who's just in the moment at the quarterly return, right? Which we all complain about, why is the Wall Street just only thinking about right now, and they don't have any long-term projection for what the industry is going to look like, what kind of cars we're going to need in 30 years. We can make that argument about capital. Why can't we make that argument about labor? Why can't we make that argument about ourselves? Stop thinking about what is just right now in front of your face and start thinking about the whole long-term development of the society and how, what kind of life do we live and how are we going to die? That was very powerful what you said. And I think that we will get further with this thing if we understand the nuances of this race problem. And for people, to read the text, which I think is very important. That's why the center has published that pamphlet. We have it downstairs. You can buy the pamphlet. and really get into it. But I just think that, and Jeff and I have had this discussion before, mm-hmm. and I just want to stick it in here in the last couple minutes.
We've got a couple, three more people. Let's go. 1, 2, 3.
I'm only disappointed that we never got to the top of Verizon or social media. And that the white race question, while important, is not the, doesn't get you there in and of itself. And that I think that people learn to, well, we tend to give up that white skin privilege in the process of struggle. You don't wake up one morning and say, you know, I'm tired of having all this extra stuff. I think that I will give it all. You know, that's the sort of give up all you have to the poor and follow me. You know, how do you learn? It's in struggle. And if there are no struggles that we are putting forward where people can learn, where we can change what are essentially bureaucratic unions into solid heuristic unions, that unless we can include that element of struggle, then I think this is necessary but not sufficient. And, you know, there is no almost no left to be able to say, to put this forward. And how do we change that also? But this is not enough to make socialism.
Well, sort of going off that a little bit, but all right. One of the questions I have is, you know, how do you combat this? And one of the ways is, it seems to me, thinking about the class is created in part by experience at work, and Bill and I both at different times worked in a shipyard where people of different races, although they were segregated within the shipyards, within departments, had to interact a whole lot. Those kinds of workplaces, whether it's, you know, big assembly lines or shipyards or steel mills, where different people come together and interact during the day and then have a common enemy, a concrete common enemy, are disappearing. So the question of where does the cross-racial experience come that's going to allow that development of struggle and create a movement that's going to be multiracial. I'm worried that that's disappearing in the United States, and in fact makes it easier to keep us separate. Let's put all the Mexicans at Smithfield, you know, and let's divide African Americans from Hispanics around work issues. White people are off somewhere else. I don't know where, but we're not mixing the way we used to. In some ways, and I think that's a serious problem that needs to be looked at. Carl, and then Steve.
Answer from Mike. I always use the thing that Ted himself says: is the hook, is the worm on the hook of the interest of the fish? But, I mean, it's very real and immediate, but is it in the interest of the fish? Short term or long term. Translated into practical reality today, in Peter County, Pennsylvania, we have a huge unemployment problem. We need green jobs. We can fight for green jobs in two ways. We can fight for green jobs to, say, modernize the locks and dams on the Ohio and get lots of construction workers and their apprentices back to work. Or we could fight for green jobs by starting where the need is greatest and drawing thousands of young black kids with caulking guns into apprenticeship programs and winterizing homes. They're both immediate programs, but one of them is fighting for green jobs with a white top and a black bottom. In fact, you won't even get to the black bottom. You only end up getting green jobs for white folks, for the most part. And the unemployed black youth will remain unemployed black youth. So that, to me, is the difference between the two approaches. It's like Marx said in the Communist Manifesto, the thing that makes us different is we take care of the whole, not just the part. And in the future, not just the present. And if you, it's only that way, by looking at each of these problems that way, that you can get rid of this fighting with a white top and a black bottom, immediate or long term. So we got to take this on, both in the immediate short range and in the strategic long range.
Okay, you want to go? I'm sorry, I just have to run. I'm sorry that you felt like this wasn't addressing the question.
No, I guess this was the wrong way to put it. It's just that it's necessary but not sufficient.
Right, but I would put it a different way. This is central.
Okay.
Right? There's other aspects to why there's no socialism. But if you don't get the question of race, you don't get anything. And what's happened in the U.S. left is that we have dallied with every other explanation, short of the invasion of aliens, to explain why no socialism. But when it comes to race, we start dancing around and don't really want to talk about it. So I think that the three of us, we share this belief that if you don't get this, you'll never get socialism. I got to run close. Thank you.
Just the one sister I need to ask quick.
I'm really happy that I'm going to be in the U.S. I'm coming from I don't know where to start, but race is so important in North America, not only in the U.S., also in Canada. But I agree with you all in all the discussions, but there's one thing I like to raise is that it gives you so much, being part of the white race, it gives you so much advantage, even though you don't have the class consciousness, especially when you travel, not only in the U.S. and Canada, even if you go to Africa, as a white person, white race is identified with so much power. In my own country, if I go to Ethiopia, which was never, it wasn't colonized, despite the fact that they fought and fought to keep their freedom, it was now a colony. We would have more power to travel freely within Ethiopia than I would have in my own first place where my grandparents fought for our freedom, and they died. They were killed by the Muslim people. And with immigration, I can go to India. If I go to India, I will be harassed. If I go to different African countries, if I go to Mexico, I will be harassed. So whereas being white, globally, provides you so much power. And so, I don't know how, it's really nice. I'm really happy you are raising this very serious issue. But it goes also beyond the U.S. border.
Thank you all for coming. Please look for yourself. Come on, come on.